invitation to come speak here. I was asked to maybe give a little bit of an introduction to the mathematical side of topological quantum computation. So I've been preaching the gospel of topological quantum computation kind of all summer, but I think today maybe this is the choir that I'm preaching to. So bear with me if maybe there's some things that are sort of your bread and butter already that you know very well. But I'd like to give some motivation for some of the model, and then go through a few ideas about what mathematics enters here. So, topological quantum computation. So here's a definition. It's a computational model built upon systems of topological phases, which now everybody knows about because of the 2016 Physics Nobel Prize. So the idea of topological quantum computation came from really two sources, Friedman and Kataev, essentially simultaneously. So Friedman published in really January of 98 this paper, P versus NP and the Quantum Field Computer. The idea here that he was pursuing was sort of trying to get some idea what the computational power of topological quantum field theories could be, and whether they could potentially be even stronger than the quantum circuit model. At the time, he didn't know. Around the same time, Kataev was thinking about building quantum computers that would be inherently fault tolerant by using anions. And this was not published until 2003, but it's a preprint in about mid-97. And actually, Friedman does mention that that paper. In this paper, he mentions this preprint. Okay. So the first thing to understand is, what are anions? And I think maybe many of us have seen this before, but let's go through it. So how does the wave function of two identical point-like particles change when you interchange their positions? Well, in R3, a well-known fact is that it can only acquire a sign at worst, because if you do it twice, you get back to the original thing. So this is the standard boson-fermion theorem. So the particle exchange in three dimensions doesn't give you much. It gives you representations of the symmetric group and not particularly interesting representations for that matter. However, in R2, one could have the possibility of anions. So what I have here is abelian anion. So the idea is that under particle exchange, it can acquire any phase. Okay. So these are anions, and abelian in particular. So let me illustrate this a little bit. So this picture really illustrates two aspects of topological quantum computation, which I think are nice. The point here is that this path C1, so I'm imagining taking one of my anions and sort of taking a small path that doesn't sort of go around the second anion. That path cannot be deformed into a path that actually does go all the way around the second thing. So that tells you that something interesting is going on, that there's some degeneracy, some topological kind of degeneracy. On the other hand, if I deviate my path C2 a little bit to the path C3, then this topologically is the same path as C2, what we started with. So this illustrates the robustness of anion models. Okay. So I find this a compelling point that really this picture encapsulates two pieces of valuable information. On the other hand, so we don't have to have just abelian anions. It's possible that the state space of a couple of anions in some medium could be multidimensional, so it could have dimension bigger than one, in which case we could obtain non-abelian anions as a possibility. So moving on, what does that mean Well, it means that particle exchange can give us representations of a far more interesting group than the symmetric group, namely the braid group on end strands. And I'll illustrate that in a bit. And there's an easy mathematical reason why this is true. It's just basic topology. If you take R3 minus some number of points and look at the fundamental group, that's trivial. On the other hand, if you take R2 and knock out some points, then the fundamental group is actually a free group on n generators if you've knocked out n points. Okay. So as I sort of alluded to, the hero of this story, at least to begin with, is the braid group. So what is this? So most of you maybe know, but it's generated, has n minus 1 generators, satisfying two kinds of relations, the first one being the ordinary sort of what we call the braid relation, and the second one, far commutation. And the picture associated with the generator is, of course, this picture here. And so you can kind of imagine just sort of thinking of time going upward in this operation as we interchange sort of particles I and I plus 1 in this setting. So that's the generators here. Another way of thinking of it is you can imagine it as being the motions of n points in a disk, which is also sometimes called the mapping class group of the punctured disk. So it looks something like this. So if you look at just the mapping class group of, for example, 6 points in a disk, you get exactly the braid group on 6 strands. Okay, so there's just some preliminaries here. So what is the topological model? How does this work? Well, here's kind of the mathematician's cartoon of this process. So what's going on here? Well, time should move upwards. So you initialize sort of, you have the vacuum to begin with, and then you're going to create anions. You create them in pairs, okay? And so this is like some topological phase transition from the vacuum to this place where we actually have these excitations, these anions. Okay, that's the initialization. And then we're going to adiabatically interchange these particles, okay? And that has the effect on the Hilbert space associated as applying some unitary gates. Okay, so that's the next step. And then you do something, some measurement, some kind of, which we might call fusion, where you sort of try to figure out what the total charge is of what the resulting thing here and here, and that's your output somehow. Okay, so that's sort of the mock-up of a topological quantum computation. Okay. So that's the idea. So let's discuss a few sort of foundational questions. So how do we model anions on surfaces? What are the state spaces? How do we model those state spaces? And what about the quantum circuits? How do we sort of run this business? Another obvious question is, why should topological quantum computation be fault tolerant? What about it is fault tolerant? And this is a slightly subtle thing, but we'll see that soon enough. And of course, key question is how powerful they are. So are they better in principle than the quantum circuit model, the same, worse, et cetera? So we'll try to address some of these. So here's a convenient definition. So a bosonic system is in topological phase if low energies, at low energies, the effective field theory is a topological quantum field theory. Okay. So now, for a mathematician, this is great because you study this topological quantum field theory and you're really studying topological phases. Okay, so we're in good shape. So let me explain a little bit about what this is, and we'll see how, in some sense, these modular categories that we've seen arise kind of organically from this setup. So it isn't just a beautiful theory. It's actually there. That was better. Oh, yeah. Okay, good point. Okay. So a 2 plus 1 dimensional TQFT assigns to any surface together with some boundary data a Hilbert space, okay? And so that's sort of a piece of it anyway. This is a two-dimensional piece of it. So we have some surface M, We have maybe some holes in the surface that we've labeled by some elements of some set, and we're going to assign to it Hilbert space. These sort of holes, these boundaries, are labeled by elements of some finite set of colors, which you should think of these as anion types. There's always the neutral color, zero, which corresponds to the vacuum. And there's some orientation reversing map, which corresponds to taking dual particles, okay, dual anions. Okay. So how does this go? Well, any surface, possibly with boundary, can be built from some basic pieces. And so the first thing we'll do is we'll write down explicitly what these basic pieces are and what Hilbert space we should assign to them. Okay, so sort of build up from the ground. So the first axiom is the disk axiom, which really goes along with the annulus axiom. So let me explain them simultaneously. Disk axiom just says, so disk has one boundary component, okay? And the idea is unless that boundary component is labeled by the vacuum, the Hilbert space should be trivial, okay? Should be zero, okay? Zero dimensional. The annulus has two boundary components, and we can get a one-dimensional Hilbert space out of that exactly when those two labels are dual to each other, and otherwise zero. So physically, this corresponds to, well, you can't create a single anion by itself out of the vacuum. You can't draw it in this way. And the annulus axiom says you can create a particle-antiparticle pair out of the vacuum. Okay, so that's what these two say. So the next thing, small piece that we're interested in looking at is the pairs of pants. Okay, so we have three labels, A, B, and C. So there's some Hilbert space associated with a pair of pants with the cuffs labeled A and B and the waist by C. And, well, we get some Hilbert space of dimension in A, B, C. And these are some choices. Okay. So those will be some integers, some natural numbers. Okay. And so the point is any surface with boundary can be chopped up into finitely many of these. Okay, a couple more axioms. The compatibility axiom. So first is the disjoint union axiom. It just says that if we have two Hilbert space, so the Hilbert space associated with two surfaces that are disjoint, okay, and we want to consider them as a single manifold surface, then the corresponding Hilbert space is just the tensor product of the two. So that's the disjoint union axiom. We also have gluing or locality. This one's a little bit harder to explain, but the idea is if you have a surface that you've obtained from another surface by gluing together a couple of boundary circles, then the corresponding Hilbert space of this surface M with its boundary labels is a direct sum over all possible labelings of the two circles you glued together. Okay, so one way of thinking of this is that sort of this Hilbert space is a sum of all of its possible histories, yeah? All of the ways we could have gotten it. And so the idea is this Hilbert space here, presumably it has lower genus, or at least not bigger. And so we keep chopping it down into smaller pieces until we get these basic pieces, and this will give us a way of understanding this. Okay? That together with this disjoint union axiom gives us these sort of consistency axioms. So the picture here is maybe we have a torus, and we want to know what is the Hilbert space associated with this torus with these labels. Well, you make a cut somewhere, and then look at just the annulus, or the cylinder, with a bunch of holes. And, well, there's some Hilbert space associated with this for each choice x. And we just sum them up. Okay. So that's this gluing, or locality. So an important piece of this is the fusion channels. So this number NABC is the dimension of the Hilbert space associated with a pair of pants. And it represents, in one way of thinking of it, as the number of ways of fusing A and B and getting the result, the resulting particle type C, label type C. Okay? This may happen in zero ways. It may happen in more than one way. Okay? But that's what this number NABC is. So you can kind of think, just from what I've written down so far, the only choice you have anywhere is NABC. Okay? So let's say you have some fixed number of labels, and you want to know, okay, I want to construct such a thing that's compatible. Well then, right, you sort of want to look at these, you sort of want to write down some NABC, and then you can start testing that no matter which way you cut up various surfaces, you always get the same answer, okay, the same dimension at least. Okay, so that's sort of one way of thinking of this. Another way of thinking of these fusion spaces is to construct a fusion matrix. So associated to a single anion or single label type, we can define a matrix NA whose BC entries are just NABC. Okay? So this gives us a nice matrix, a finite size matrix associated to each simple to each label or each anion. So the first principle I want to point out here is that what are we going to use for our computational space? Well, typically, what one uses is you take the disk with a bunch of holes labeled by anion type A and look at the corresponding Hilbert space. So this is the state space of N identical type A anions and a disk. This is our computational space. So let me give a couple of examples, probably familiar to most of you. So the first is the Fibonacci. So the Fibonacci has two particle types, 0 and 1. Its fusion matrix looks like this. Okay, so we've already seen the fusion rules. These were written down already by Cesar. So we have this fusion matrix, and one can notice that the dimension of the computational space is the nth Fibonacci number. Okay, so that's why it has this name. Another is the Ising theory. So now we have three labels, 0, 1, and 2. The interesting particle, so this is the sigma particle in the usual setup, has fusion matrix looking like this. And, well, the dimension of the corresponding Hilbert space is just 2 to the n in this case. Okay. Corresponding space, okay. Much more generally, what you're looking for is a modular tensor category. So it turns out that when you want to construct a TQFT, the most natural thing to do is start with a modular category, take the simple objects as your label set, and your morphism spaces as the Hilbert spaces. And I'll show that in a moment. But this is just a very general way of doing it, and in some sense, this is the only way of constructing 2 plus 1 TQFTs if you're careful about adding a few modifiers, okay, to these. So some sources of modular tensor categories. One source is quantum groups. So let me quickly go through how this is done. So you start with a Lie algebra, G. You look at its universal enveloping algebra. You deform that universal enveloping algebra, deform the relations, essentially. And you get something called a quantum group, UQG. You specialize at a root of unity. You get the representation category of this then, after specialization. And this is an interesting category, but it's not semi-simple, and it doesn't have finitely many simple objects. However, you can mod out by a tensor ideal called the annihilator of the trace and get a nice category, which very often is going to be modular. Okay. So you refer to these as CGL, because that's really all they depend on. So this is really the most ubiquitous source of interesting modular categories. Okay. And was already mentioned, it's here on the board somewhere, it seems like these constructions very likely sort of generate all Witt classes. Okay, so in some sense, maybe this is all of them up to Witt equivalents. Okay. You can also take Drenfeld doubles, twisted Drenfeld doubles of groups, or Drenfeld centers, as we've already seen. There's plenty of other constructions. But anyway, so we've seen these before. So there's lots of sources. One theorem that we recently proved is that if you fix an integer k and you ask how many modular categories are there with exactly k simple objects up to isomorphism, well, there's finitely many. So this is known as the rank finiteness theorem. And so in some sense, it's telling us that if you want a TQFT and you know that you have exactly six anion types that are distinguishable, then there are only going to be finitely many possible matches to that. Okay? So that already reduces things down a bit. It's not such a wild question. It also really suggests that it's hard, I mean, extremely hard to be a TQFT. Question?
How many? Is there an exponent?
So if you want to know the asymptotics, it's at least super polynomial. But for k less than, strictly less than 6, they're completely classified. So at least for modest cases, we've got a good handle on it.
Thank
you. Sure. So another way of saying this is just if you fix the number of distinguishable indecomposable anion types, there are only going to be finitely many possible models for that. Okay, so let me give a dictionary just like Cesar did. Maybe it'll look a bit similar. So here's a dictionary. So it's possible to pass between these two things. And the nice thing is that if you have some thing that you want to study in quantum information or in topological phases of matter, many times you can translate that question into a category theory question and sort of study it from that aspect. So as we already saw, the anion types, those correspond to simple objects in a modular category. The vacuum is the trivial object. The antiparticle is just duals. The pairs of pants are these fusion state spaces, fusion channels. Braiding is just particle exchange. All of these various physical properties have a direct translation into modular categories. And one thing that I was really puzzled about when I first started studying this is why do we need actual modularity? Why isn't it just that braided fusion categories are enough? So it turns out that in order to have a measurement that will distinguish anion types, you need the determinant of S, so that you need modularity, okay? So that you can exactly see that this is why modularity is so important. You want to distinguish distinguishable anion types. Something called topological spin. And then again, as I mentioned before, we have the in-anion state space. What is the appropriate associated thing? Well, it's in some sense, there's maybe some slight change to this, but it's the endomorphism algebra of X tensor N. Okay. So you have, if you have N type X particles, this is the appropriate state space. Or possibly some module over that algebra. But anyway, I don't want to get into the details about that. OK, so we have this dictionary. So what about topological circuits? How do we understand these? Well, if you fix an anion A, then the braid group obviously acts on this endomorphism space by particle exchange, by permuting tensor factors, by using the braiding. And so you obtain a braid group representation, in fact, a unitary one, on this computational space. So now our gates, quantum gates, are simply the images of the generators of the braid group. Okay? So you can just imagine, physically, we're just doing a particle interchange. And quantum circuits are, well, more general things. So they are just images of braids themselves. So of course, a quantum circuit. So since this is a representation, this can, of course, be factored into a product of these sigma i's. And then it's clear that that's what we mean. Okay, so it's a little different than the quantum circuit model, for sure. So here's the first principle that I think maybe not everyone views in this way, but why is it that we have fault tolerance? Well, one reason is that information in the topological model is delocalized, okay? You expect the errors will be local, so some small perturbation. Maybe your anion isn't exactly where you wanted it to be. But as long as that change isn't very much, then your sort of that isn't going to change the Hilbert space at all. It won't change the state at all. And moreover, when you want to do some non-trivial operation, it has to be in some sense global, okay? At least, you know, moving two particles around each other. Okay? So this, I think, is why fault tolerance shows up in this topological model, is really because of this delocalization of information. Okay? And in a moment, I'll give you maybe a bit more of an argument for why this is true. So the quantum gates are non-local. They look local, right? They're physically local. You're taking sort of two things that are near each other and interchanging them. But algebraically, they're not local because they're smearing this state space all around inside itself. Okay, when you actually apply these operators, it isn't in some nice interchange of two adjacent tensor factors kind of form. Okay. Now, it turns out that you can, in a certain sense, localize the topological model. So Friedman, Gataev, and Wang showed that topological quantum computers have a hidden locality, and that hidden locality means that we can actually try to simulate braiding of anions on a quantum circuit model. So how does that work? Well, suppose we have some braid, and we have some unitary operator associated with that braid given by the image of the braid group representation. And we take that U and we want to simulate it on some tensor power of some fixed vector space V, fixed, for some tensor power that, of course, depends on N, because this is N here. And we want to simulate it by local gates, so a product of local gates. Okay? Local in the quantum circuit model sense. How do you do that? Well, it turns out that there is a ready-made vector space for you. You simply take the vector space, which is the sum of all of the Hilbert spaces associated with pairs of pants, where we run over all triples ABC of labels. Okay, it's a finite set. So this is a finite dimensional vector space. And that's the basic space, V, that we want to use. And then it turns out, yeah, and so then we take the n minus first tensor power, and it turns out to be enough. And then just the axioms of TQFT, so gluing, disjoint union, et cetera, imply that our computational space, Hn, lives inside this sort of quantum circuit-looking Hilbert space as a direct sum n. So what that means is that if you have a universal quantum circuit quantum computer, then that means that you can apply any unitary on this space you like. Okay, that's what universality means in that sense. And so in particular, the image of beta, which is acting on here, you can simulate that one. It's just another unitary in there somewhere. So this is how they showed that topological quantum computers are no more powerful than the quantum circuit model. Okay, they're actually polynomial equivalent.
Yes.
Yeah. Anticipated. Okay. So this is a scheme. It always works for any TQFT. Okay. But a remark here is that V, of course, can be quite large. Yeah. We're summing over quite a large bunch of things here. And as I pointed out, this braid, or the unitary operator associated with the braid, only acts on a subspace, which could be quite a bit smaller than this non-computational space over here. So whereas in principle you can do it, and in fact in practice one could as well, the point is that it's maybe not ideal. Okay, it seems like there's a lot of stuff here that's annoying, okay? It's sort of in our way. So another idea is, well, we know some local operators that braid. They're called braided vector spaces. So what's that? It's just a solution to the Yang-Baxter equation, okay? Let's say unitary. And if you have a unitary solution to the Yang-Baxter equation, so it's just like a matrix equation, then you get a sequence of local Bragg group representations given in the usual way. Okay? So we just let the ith generator of the Bragg group act on the I and I plus first tensor factors and the identity the rest of the time. And this is manifestly local. Okay? You can see it right here. So this is sort of in an input vector. When we apply the this operator, it only acts on these pair, this pair here. Okay, so very much local. So this is a sequence, in fact, of local braid group representations. So wouldn't it be nice if we could use such things to try to simulate topological quantum computers? So the idea here is, you can imagine this a solution to the Yang-Baxter equation as being a gate set consisting of a single matrix, a single operator. Okay? And well, that's our gate set, and we're going to see, you know, what can we do with it. So it's sort of a braided quantum circuit lawn, in some sense. Okay? So from this, we gave a definition. So a localization of a sequence of braid group representations is, well, a fixed braided vector space, RW, some injective algebra maps from the braid group algebra image to matrices on this vector space W tensor N, so that the following diagram commutes. So let me try to explain this a little bit in some detail. So here's the representations that we're getting, say, from braiding anions. Okay, that's this rho sub n. Okay, so, and this is just its image. Okay, so I've just written it in this way. This is somehow sitting inside an endomorphism algebra of some fixed simple object in a braided fusion category. On the other hand, I have another kind of representation coming from my solution of the Yang-Baxter equation, rho upper R. And what I want is that there should be some algebra map, so an actual map of that respects both the addition and the multiplication here, that makes this whole thing commute. Okay? What that means in particular is that if we had some sub-representation here, some irreducible sub-representation of this braid group representation, it would definitely appear over here. Moreover, anything that appears over here, an irreducible constituent, already appeared over here. So we haven't introduced anything, any new representations or any new pieces of sort of new information. It's all the information that was already there, just maybe with higher multiplicity in some sense. So the irreducible representations here and here are exactly the same as sort of sets, if you like. Okay, so that's a localization. Seems like too much to ask. But the idea here is we want to use this to push braiding gates inside a braided quantum circuit model. So you might wonder, when can you do this? Well, you sometimes can, rather surprisingly perhaps. So look at this R matrix. This is my favorite 4x4 matrix. It satisfies the Yang-Baxter equation. It's unitary, okay? And it's not just a permutation matrix. It's actually something interesting. And we proved many years ago, 10 at least, that in fact this particular braided vector space localizes the Ising theory. Okay, so it is possible to localize something in this sense. Okay, the thing to notice here, and let's do a little comparison. This object X is not a vector space; as it doesn't even have. There's no fiber functor. I mean, there's nothing you could do. This is the Ising theory. It's not a vector space. If you use the hidden locality technique of Kataev Friedman and Wang, then the corresponding vector space V has dimension 10. And so the space Wn that we were using to local to use this hidden locality to simulate this topological quantum computer on a quantum circuit model has dimension 10 to the n minus 1. Okay? Whereas the dimension of Hn is actually 2 to the n. I was a bit lazy. I didn't want to check at the time, but it's exactly 2 to the n. So this is, right, 2 to the n, of course, I mean, these are just numbers, so 2 to the n is a polynomial and 10 to the n, right, et cetera. That's not a problem. But the point is that you are losing quite a bit here by using this big 10-dimensional vector space, right? That's sort of annoying to use qdits where d is 10, whereas it seems like we can get away with a lot less, right, because it's the dimension is only 2 to the n, okay? So it is possible to localize in this way sometimes. However, we proved some years later that the Fibonacci is not localizable. Definitively, it's impossible to find a localization in our sense. Okay. So let me pass for a moment to the question of computational power, so universality. So when does an anion provide universal computation models? How can we tell when this happens? Well, another way of saying this is, when can any quantum circuit be approximately realized by a braiding circuit? Okay, so this is the other direction, right? You would like to know, can you simulate any quantum circuit, any universal quantum circuit computer on an appropriately chosen topological quantum computer? So that's the question here. It turns out that the Fibonacci, you can. Okay, so Fibonacci is universal. We kind of know this. That was proved by Friedman, Larson, and Wang in 02. The Ising is not. Okay, the Ising anion is not universal. Particle exchange only generates a finite group, and that was already known to Jones in probably earlier than 86, but that's when the paper was published. So to prove that the Fibonacci anion is universal, kind of the key is you look at the braid group representation, the image of the braid group under its representation associated with Fibonacci anion. Then you look at its closure, and one can prove that it contains sort of the biggest group you could possibly hope to have. So in this case, this braid group representation is reducible. It has two irreducible components of dimension Fn and Fn minus 1, where these are the Fibonacci numbers. And so the most you could hope for, since it's unitary and you can't control phases, is Su. Okay? And so here, that's how this Hn decomposes. And I've just, this is the most convenient way of writing what this Fibonacci number is. Okay, so that's sort of the key to proving that the Fibonacci anion is universal, is sort of to look at these images. Okay, so let me introduce quantum dimensions. So you've seen them a little bit already, but for me, everything is going to be unitary, so I have a somewhat easier definition. So pick your anion type A, look at its object, and then look at the associated fusion matrix in A. Look at its maximal eigenvalue. It'll be the Perron-Frobenius eigenvalue is what it's called. That's how we define the dimension. That's the dimension of this object. Physically, you can think of these as sort of loop amplitudes, sort of a creating and then annihilating type A particle, something like this. One thing to point out is that the dimension of the computational space is asymptotic to the dimension of A to the n. Okay. And notice, I said maximal, which means in particular it ought to be real, and it is. So this has a maximal real eigenvalue, and it's bigger in modulus than any other eigenvalue. And so that's it certainly exists, and so this sort of makes sense. Everything is real here, but not necessarily an integer by any means. For UQG, it coincides with the usual notion of quantum dimension that one often sees. So the ones we've looked at so far carefully is the Ising. The Ising particle has dimension squared of 2, whereas the Fibonacci particle has dimension the golden mean. Okay. So, so let's think for a moment what we know. So we know that the Ising anion is not universal, but can be localized. The Fibonacci anion cannot be localized, but is universal. Okay, so they're very different in this way. Okay. So this suggests that maybe there is one statistic to rule them all, and that is this quantum dimension. So let me give a couple other statistics about an anion. An anion would be called non-abelian if the image of the Bragg group representation obtained from that anion is non-abelian group. Okay? You can imagine it could be abelian if, for example, A was the vacuum or any other one-dimensional particle. We'll call it universal if the closed image of the Bragg group representation is infinite modulo the center, and I should maybe say eventually, right? For all n beyond some fixed n. So this is maybe an unconventional definition of universal, but I want to use this definition because in reality, this is pretty much enough. Okay. Localizable, we've already seen the definition of this, but the idea is the anion A will be localizable if this sequence of Bragg group representations is localizable. In other words, if this group image of this group can be simulated on a quantum circuit model using this Yang-Baxter operator. Okay? So it's localization. So these are three things that an anion may or may not have. And so here's the principle. All of these are determined by the dimension of A, dimension of this particle. Non-abelian anions, when are these non-abelian? When is an anion non-abelian? It's exactly when the dimension is strictly bigger than one. That's a theorem due to me and Zhenghang Wang. Conjecturally, so this is the property F conjecture that I made around 2007, is that the anion A is universal precisely when the dimension squared is not an integer. On the other side of that, we would say that if the dimension squared is an integer, that in fact it fails to be universal in a very bad way, that it's actually finite on the nose. Okay. And moreover, localizable, we conjectured with Zhenghang Wang, that an anion is localizable precisely when the dimension squared of is actually an integer. Okay, this is also conjectural. So this suggests that basically if in the lab you can compute or measure somehow this quantum dimension, this dim of A, accurately enough to know whether its square is an integer or not, then you would be able to know whether it is a universal anion or not, whether it's non-abelian at least or not. So this is a couple of different conjectures. And let me point out that it's been checked basically for all of the ones that people know. If you look at sort of the so-called fundamental anions in any quantum group model, so what I mean by that is you sort of take an object in the corresponding modular category corresponding to a minuscule highest weight. So there's some way of thinking about this. Those have been checked completely. Okay, we know that if the dimension squared is an integer, we can prove it's localizable and has finite Bragg group image. Otherwise, it has infinite Bragg group image. Okay? And then this is a theorem in general. Let me show you in the last little bit here kind of how we prove things in this to kind of get our hands a little bit dirty. So let me illustrate the proof of this statement here. So suppose we have an anion whose dimension is bigger than one, then in particular one can show that there is some non-vacuum object B that appears in the second tensor power of A. In other words, it's possible to fuse A with itself and get something other than the vacuum. Okay? That's one can see that knowing this dimension is strictly bigger than one implies that. Okay, so that's the first step. Now, let's look at this picture here. So, we start with the vacuum over here. We create a pair of particle-antiparticle, so A and A star, let's say, and then we have A here. And now, if you look, sort of just cut it along here and along here, what's in here is exactly the commutator of sigma 1 and sigma 2. Okay. So, if you do the usual diagrammatic yoga of the graphical calculus, you find that this is a non-zero quantity. Okay. The point is, it's possible to pick the, as long as you've picked this vector here to be non-zero, the vector that is AAB. As long as you've picked that to be non-zero, the resulting thing here will be non-zero as well. Okay? You can kind of imagine that, right? You kind of untwist at the cost of some root of unity, some scalar shows up here. You can kind of move some things around a bit. But the point is, these two are scalar multiples of each other. What are these? These are vectors in some Hilbert space. Okay? And it's non-zero. On the other hand, if particle exchange is just some multiple of the identity, if the commutator of particle exchange, so if this full particle exchange is just a multiple of the identity, then we'd have the following picture. So this commutator between sigma 1 and sigma 2 would just become sort of three straight strands, and we'd have an additional scalar here. Okay? So the idea, suppose this commutator is just the identity on AAA times some scalar, then this is what the picture that we would get. We'd get this equality. Okay? But now, this is zero. Can someone see why? So V here is the vacuum. Exactly. It's the disk axiom. Right? Here we start with the vacuum. We move along here, and we've produced a non-trivial particle. That must be zero. Okay? So this is a proof, diagrammatic proof, that if the dimension of a particle is bigger than one, then, in fact, you get non-abelian anions. So just having dimension bigger than one is enough. Lucy? Mm-hmm. Oh, 5 minutes. Okay. Good. Let me just say a few other things. So the story doesn't end here at all. There are lots of refinements, and people in the audience, I think, have considered many of these refinements. So I'll just mention that this story really goes back to sort of some years ago, quite a bit of it. There are lots of new ways of thinking of these things to sort of recover universality, etc. So one idea is to consider three-dimensional materials. And in this case, we saw before that point-like particles in three dimensions is totally useless. But that doesn't say loop-like particles or loop-like excitations are not. And as a mathematician, I'm very naive about physics. And so, right, it seems plausible to me. So we could study loop-like excitations. And in fact, there's some physics papers that I can refer to that they actually do think about this. At some point, I said bosonic topological phases of matter. There's one issue, which is, what about including fermions? Fermions are sort of have this non-local behavior to them. And we've started to study these in the context of fermionic modular categories. And let me just make a point of contact with the last talk. So we saw that if you start with the braided fusion categories, you could modularize and get a modular category. Not always. It turns out that sometimes if you have a fermion in your Mueger center, I like the word Mueger here, then you can't get a fusion category by de-equivariantizing. The reason is along, probably on this board here somewhere, it needed to be commutative, okay? If A is commutative, then it's a tensor category. Well, if you take 1 plus a fermion, this is not a commutative algebra. It's an algebra, but it's not commutative. And so you have to think a little bit more carefully about that. And it turns out you can just like you can condense a boson, which is what's going on with modularization, you can condense a fermion, but the result won't be a tensor category. It'll be a super tensor category. And so now there's a whole theory that one can study in parallel. But the point is still there, that if you want to study braided fusion categories up to some finite groups, it's enough finite groups and fermions. It's enough to study modular categories or fermionic modular categories. There's only these two possibilities. What about gapped boundaries, defects? You can add a little extra information in there and try to use these to get some topological operations that would give you universality, for example. Symmetry-enriched topological phases. So there's some experts in the audience on these. Measurement-assisted protocols. So these have also been studied where you don't restrict yourself to just braiding. You also allow yourself to do some measurement sometimes. You do some measurement, and the results of that measurement tell you whether to continue or to start over. Okay, so you can recover universality sometimes using this. Okay. So this is my research group at Texas A&M. So thank you.
Just to your comments at the last bit, I just want to mention I'm really interested actually in the idea of extending to three-dimensional models using string-like excitations, particularly because I haven't worked on it since, but this paper that I had with John Baez and Alyssa Kranz using the loop braid group and representations. The thing that I've worried about though is, do you lose all of the nice features of anions that give you full tolerance, just because there is a symmetric exchange as well as the non-symmetric exchange where you actually pass one loop through another one. I don't know if you have any ideas about that.
Yeah, so I think that if sort of at least sort of from the high point of view, if you start with a 3+1 TQFT, you should get representations of motion groups of loops, for example. And I see no reason why, at least mathematically, there's no reason that you should lose universality. However, there is a conjecture due to Jus Slingerland that suggests that at least if you consider only those that are local, so sort of take a solution to the Yang-Baxter equation and then extend it using the symmetric group representation somehow, that these again will be only finite. So the real question maybe is there any interesting 3+1 TQFTs that give you something more than finite group data and maybe spin structure? And I think, as far as I know, nobody has a definitive answer to that question. So quite potentially, we lose universality, but we'll see.
Yeah. Thanks.
Could you go back to the slide with the conjectures on dimension being square of the dimension? Yeah.
Yes.
If both conjectures are true, an anion is universal if and only if it is not localizable.
That's right.
Might there be hope of proving that, sidestepping the dimension aspect?
Yes. So in fact, so that would be one way of, there's actually, of course, there's lots of sort of, there's a whole triangle of ideas. One would be, can you prove that any unitary solution to the Yang-Baxter equation has finite image, braid group image? That would be one thing. In fact, very often, in order to prove that we have finite braid group image, we find a localization and analyze that representation. So yeah, certainly there's some hope. But I feel like this statement that you made sort of at least is a symptom of the fact that fault tolerance comes from non-locality. So it makes perfect sense in this regard.